friends that asked for a copy told me today.
Yeah, I'll get you one. So thank you for your questions and your time this evening. I appreciate it. So I want to talk more about this practice. There might be questions you have, and maybe I'll answer some of those questions in this talk. So this idea of using heart practices and mindfulness practices as actually a simultaneous cultivation can have some learning curves with the questions we can see. Like, sometimes it might take us a little while to kind of get it. But I have found it to be the most useful and efficient way to practice. And I really teach this now. It's kind of the system of teaching that I offer. When I work with people one-on-one, I have people teach and I train in this way. And many of my retreats are entitled Metta Vipassana. So it's where I've landed as sort of an integrative way of practicing. So starting at perhaps the beginning, one thing that I could say I think that might be helpful in the arena of what we have perhaps privileged or perhaps have to some degree culturally put a lot of emphasis on the importance of mindfulness. And when we look at the history of insight practice in the last 40 years in our culture, mindfulness, vipassana, insight has kind of become the top dog, if you will. And these heart practices have essentially been sort of taught as a, like, if you feel like it, maybe afterwards, you know, if you're into it, you could maybe have some kindness and some compassion. You know. And that's how, and I was grateful for that, because I'll be totally honest with you. The first many retreats I went on, when they did the 4 o'clock heart practice session, I didn't even go into the meditation hall. I could not do these. I shouldn't say that. I should probably say I would not. I something about it was, I think it was the language, the loving kindness, again, back to that, was really hard for me, because the word love carried with it, with me, actually more suffering than probably any other term, because much of my life and much of my suffering had been experienced as a result of a loving relationship ending tragically. I had a lot of death and loss in my early life. So the idea of loving kindness just got me so triggered right out of the gate that I didn't even really want to bother. So many, many years later, I was very happy to learn that the metta translation is really that of kindness and friendliness. But that's actually the root etymological definition of the word, which I actually have no problem getting behind that. The word kindness doesn't trigger me at all. Right. So I've had a very long struggle personally with these practices. So I also like to say that I want to acknowledge that this can be challenging for many people. And so when we look at mindfulness, we could say mindfulness practices are awareness practices, and they're about recognizing objects or foundations, or I would say fields of experience. So mindfulness, in many ways, is about training our attention to be able to focus on a simple aspect of the human experience. So we have the field of the body, so we concentrate on the breath and the body. And the mind wanders, we come back to the body. That creates presence, that creates a sense of samadhi, ease, collectedness. It also breaks the addiction to thinking. It also helps alleviate some of our suffering, because much of our suffering is in the abstract, my life, self domain. And so we train in that way, we become more familiar with that. We see what arises out of the body is the field of feeling, or vedana. That every sensation has a quality of it being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral on a very gross to subtle scale. And we learn how to recognize that. And we learn that we react, that this is what gets us in trouble. Much of the Buddhist teaching is about feeling. If it feels good, I cling to it. If it feels unpleasant, I push it away. Have you seen yourself do that at times? And this causes a whole wide range of issues. So we recognize that basic Buddhist psychology, that our organism is dictated by this pleasure-pain dichotomy. So it's in our best interest to be able to recognize that. And then we have the mind field. I love that term, don't you? Mind field. And that's a very interesting aspect of mindfulness, sometimes called mindfulness of mind, which is extremely unhelpful. But it's the mind state. What is the state of the mind? What is the attitude of mind? Is there an attitude of wanting or not wanting? And what is the emotion in the mind? Now, emotion isn't present in every moment, but there's always a mind state, a perception, a mental attitude, and you can learn to recognize those. And then in the fourth field of mindfulness, we have mindfulness of dhammas, which again, not such a helpful term. Joseph Goldstein calls it categories of experience. And there's a whole bunch of sets of them. There's the hindrances, craving, aversion, restlessness, lethargy, and doubt. There's aggregates, feelings, perceptions, inclinations, consciousness. But it's really the mental activities. It's what the mind is doing. It's planning, it's remembering, it's judging, it's calculating, it's rehearsing. Are you familiar with these mental activities? Mm-hmm. And that's a field of our awareness. That's really more the psychological field. In mindfulness, we train to just recognize those. It's almost like a four-speed, you know? The body field is slow, so you got to slow down, get in the body field. The fourth foundation, the four-speed, is really fast thinking. So we just kind of learn to find our way around. And it's understood and taught in Satipatthana, which is sort of the mindfulness Bible, if you will, that these practices lead to liberation. That when practiced and applied and brought into full fruition, the Satipatthana, the four foundations of mindfulness, arrive into these awakening factors, and it's the direct path of liberation. Very strong language. And many insight teachers who I actually love and respect, don't teach metta bhavana, they don't teach these heart practices, because they believe that if mindfulness practiced and applied will actually arrive into these heart qualities, which is also the understanding. So Satipatthana leads to these heart qualities. Ironically, these heart qualities also lead to awakening. So I find it's good to, I like to double dip myself. And when we look at these metta practices, there's a way in which there's not, where awareness practices are more about objects, to recognize an object, to recognize a feeling, to recognize the in-breath, to recognize a thought, to recognize an emotion. Recognize. Very useful. But the heart qualities, these metta bhavana practices, are more of a relational field. Dare I say, sometimes I like to think of them as a healing field. And it's harder to access these emotional healing fields because there's a nonverbal component to the heart practices. There's a nonverbal component to kindness. You know what the word means. You kind of understand how it works. But to be able to access an embodied experience of kindness takes time. How long does it take to find the in-breath? It's right there. Boom. Got it. Piece of cake. Kindness, find the kindness. Where is it? Mm-hmm. I don't feel so kind. See, I feel quite judgmental. It's harder. It's a different kind of experience. It's a different kind of field. But it's certainly there. It's certainly accessible. And it can certainly be cultivated. We can learn to find it. We can learn to access it. We can sustain it. Just like we can sustain concentration on breathing, we can also sustain concentration on kindness. Now, I don't know about you, but I would rather be good at being kind than being good at breathing. It has had much more positive results. Does that make sense? You guys with me? And I feel very strongly that in the modern arena of mindfulness practices, people are overemphasizing the foundational aspects and not so much the heart practices, which I feel is a bit of a tragedy to some degree. So when we look at metta vipassana, what we're really trying to do, if we look at the thread that ties all the practices together, is that the Buddha in vipassana practice, which is a little different than mindfulness. Mindfulness, as in the awakening factors, is the first of seven factors to awaken. And the second factor is investigation. Sometimes we use this word And mindfulness, we say we concentrate and we investigate, which is weird because it sounds like a CSI crime show.
Going to investigate the Dharma.
And I like what? But it's a way of seeing into what is it that's arising. In all of the Buddhist teachings, as I'm sure you know or starting to learn, a lot of the Dharma rests in these three characteristics or these three qualities. Anicca, dukkha, anatta, which is that everything is impermanent. This is one of the Buddha's liberating insights, is that all experience is impermanent and ever-changing. Everything is anicca, which actually translates as permanence, but actually in the Pali, it's anicca, which means not absolute. So the Buddha's saying there's no absolutes. Everything is completely up in the air and totally unreliable. You're like, whoa, man. Which actually, I don't know about you, but that kind of spooks me a little bit. I'm like, whoa, nothing is reliable? There's got to be something in this world that's reliable. And it's always changing. We're in this flux of change. Everything is dukkha. Everything is difficult. Dissatisfactoriness. Dukkha is really hard to translate. You probably know this word. But dukkha is such a great word, right? Because it doesn't sound like, you know what it sounds like, right? Dukkha. Difficult. Every quality in the universe carries with it a characteristic of change, of dukkha, and of anatta, which is not self. So each one gets a little bit stranger. Change, impermanence, I got that one. Dukkha, I got it, but a little bit harder. But this not self business, pretty hard. I feel like I'm a self. Do you feel like you're a person who has a self? I do. But so when we look at those characteristics from the view of Vipassana or insight or mindfulness, I find that they can be very destabilizing. They can almost be traumatizing because it's really pointing to this groundless ground of lived experience. Everything is changing. Everything is unreliable. There's this not self. And we can see that meditatively. If we sit long retreats or we practice, we start to see, oh yeah, that actually is true. Life is a constant changing, flowing of events. Even though the schedule in my phone tells me what's going on all week, there's a whole bunch of stuff that's going to happen in the next couple of days that ain't in my phone. And probably some of the stuff in my phone actually won't happen. And I'll be upset about that. So I think it's very interesting to try to bring metta, not sati, mindfulness, to these three characteristics, which I think is helpful, but I think it's been very valuable to me to bring metta to these three characteristics. May I be at ease with change. Are you kind and friendly and at ease with change? Do you like change? Somebody says they're going to do something and they don't do it? Somebody dies? You lose your job? Your financial situation gets pulled out from underneath you. There's a lot of ways in which our relationship to change. So if metta is a relational field, then we want to be able to have a relational quality to the reality of change and unreliability and all of that kind of experience. So when change actually happens, we don't like check it off and go, got it. First characteristic of experience, I've investigated change. We're like, no, oh my God, I have feelings about this change. This change is difficult for me. This is not change that I like. Some change is good. There's gain. Some change is a sense of gain. Some change is a sense of loss. Some change is a sense of pleasure, a sense of pain. But how can we be at ease with the reality of change? I travel a lot and I find myself up against this often. I'm currently in the middle of a big trip and all of my travel arrangements have gone kind of bad and they've all been my fault. And I could have really suffered a lot about this. For example, I pulled up to, I buy a lot of tickets online and I have a little bit of dyslexia. I have some learning stuff that's not great. And I struggle with this AM, PM thing. I wish we'd switch to military time, frankly. So I pull up to LAX, which is a very unpleasant airport if you've ever been there. And for my 12:55 flight on Sunday, it's 11 a.m. Gonna go get a Starbucks, wait an hour, get on the plane. Awesome. And I'm looking at my phone and I'm like, it says arrived like at 4. And I'm like looking at it, I'm like, this isn't right. And I'm like, oh, my flight was at 12:55 a.m. my flight was 13 hours ago, and I didn't get on it. And I'm jumping out of the Uber at LAX, and I have no flight. And I'm like, this is change. Things have changed. You know, panic, fear, blame. Gonna cost me money. Just a whole drop-down menu of suffering. You're stupid. You screwed up again. It's gonna cost you money. You're traveling to make money. You're not even gonna make any money. You suck at life, dude. You know, this is like 17 seconds to go, and I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. Let's not do that. Let's just take a couple breaths. No big deal. I'm at LAX. They have flights all over the world every 17 seconds. And I calmed down, and I got it together, and I got, a ticket that wasn't too bad to the place I was going to, and I had to wait at LAX for 6 hours. And I read some, I made some phone calls, I listened to some Dharma talks. I actually had quite a good time. I had a cheeseburger. It was pretty good. You know, food at the airport usually sucks. So I was like, this is kind of nice. Totally could have gone way different. What made that experience what it was metta, not mindfulness. Mindfulness kind of gave me the ability to understand the territory that I was standing in. But that's not enough. See, I think the problem here is mindfulness is really great, and I'm not here at all to speak in any derogatory way about mindfulness, but it's just not enough. It doesn't give us that relational quality feel that we want to try to bring to that experience. Sure, it gave me the ability to recognize all of what was happening outside, on the curb, LAX, no plane, gonna call, you know, it gave me all that data. It was like mindfulness was like, yo, check it out, dude. You fucked up. It did. That's what it did. And I was like, oh, man. But it was actually this whole other practice that allowed me to kind of, and I actually had a great day. Truth be told. 2 days later, I am in Denver, and I'm flying here. And sometimes I have too much meta, like was like your question. I assume things are going to work out. I'm like, yeah, it'll be fine. I do have this it'll be fine attitude, and it often burns me because it doesn't turn out to be fine. But I had a flight from Grand Junction to Denver, and then a flight from Denver to Nashville, but I was already in Denver. I was like, I just won't get on my Grand Junction flight. I'm already in Denver. No big deal. I'm like, I better call the airline. Call the airline, they're like, yeah, man, if you don't get on Grand Junction, you lose your whole ticket. And you gotta buy a whole new ticket. So I'm like, I'm in my friend's house, and it's like gonna cost me like $1,100 to switch it and everything. So I'm tripping. And I'm like, I'm a bad traveler. And then here comes the drop-down menu. Bad traveler, not smart, bad choices, gonna cost money. Like, you just did this 2 days ago. Like, you need an assistant. It's just like suffering, 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 mindfulness of suffering. And so I relaxed. And I was like, okay, what do I need to do? I need to get to Grand Junction. So I go to the Denver airport, rent a car for $80, drive 4 hours over the Rocky Mountains through the snow to Grand Junction, get on my plane and come here. Wow. Had a great time. Great time. Listen to Dharma talks, listen to music. I'm also actually feel a little embarrassed even telling this because I was negotiating this. I was like, this is a great Dharma talk, but I was like, don't tell anybody. It was the metta. It was okay, this is the conditions, may I be at ease. This is the conditions, may I be at ease. These are the conditions, may I be at ease. Mm. You know? Some compassion for myself. I'm like, yeah, you make mistakes. You really, really dropped the ball on the buying the plane tickets on this trip. Okay, forgiveness. Appreciation that I was able to kind of manage it in a way that wasn't so bad. Here I am, I made it. That feels good. And so bringing metta, kindness, to actually the reality of change, that will keep you busy on most days if you just actually try that. Like, if you take that practice on, I dare you, right? But really see if you can, when you're confronted with real change, if you can recognize it with the mindfulness and go, right, in this Ajahn Sumedho quote, we love it against the stream, right now it's like this. Right now it's like this. Right now, curbside LAX, no plane ticket.
Wow.
Right. And that brings us into this second characteristic of dukkha, which I don't like to translate because it's really hard to translate, but this idea of challenge, things are challenging, things are difficult, things are unsatisfying. Can I learn to tolerate the difficult nature of reality? Things don't go your way sometimes. People don't always say what they're going to do. Situations come, they go. You know, we sometimes get what we want, sometimes we don't get what we don't want. Sometimes we get what we don't want. People that we don't like come into our direct experience. People that we love leave our experience. This is how it is, right? We know that. You totally know that already. I'm not like giving you some profound Buddhist teaching right now. You're like, yeah, dude, we get it. But how are you when that actually happens? Right? Are you able to have some resiliency? Are you able to stay online? Are you able to recognize this kind of field of dukkha in this particular moment and then learn how to cope or learn how to reduce the suffering that might arise in result to that experience? Can you do that? You can do that. You can learn that. That's a skill that's learnable. You know, I've been really interested in Richie Davidson lately because him and Daniel Goleman wrote a book called Altered Traits, which is the science of mindfulness. And one of the things two things that come out of that science I think is interesting. So they've been studying the effects of meditation on people's brains, like in a scientific laboratory, which is pretty cool, actually. Talk about CSI. And they hook people up with all these electrodes and see what meditation does to them. Two things that came out of that I've heard recently that I'm very interested in is actually Daniel Goleman was talking about how this metta practice actually has measurable, beneficial results for the people who will practice it almost immediately. That when somebody engages in a metta practice, a daily metta practice, very early in the first 90 days of the practice, their actual physiological experience changes for the better. And they report being able to navigate their relationships a little bit better with their friends and their loved ones. That actually, in all of the research that they've done, metta practices have a much faster result. Which is interesting, because a lot of the questions point to the opposite. They're like, well, how do I do this? But when done, it has these great effects. The other thing that they've noticed is that retreat practice, like silent retreats, 3 days, 5 days, 7 days, that they test people before retreat and after retreat, and the amount of experience and the benefit on the mind-body system in a retreat has really, really, really tremendous results. Actually, much more so than daily sitting practice. So I was like, yes, retreats and metta are so good for you. Those are my two favorite things. And this last thing, I'll take some questions here. I'm going to just close here in a bit. I don't want to lose where I am. And then the last one, I think, is very, very important and interesting as we talk about self. So whether you can recognize self or not self meditatively is one thing. But how can you relate to the self, yourself? What would it be like if you were able to be more kind and more benevolent and more friendly to yourself? One of the questions that I got asked many, many years ago that actually changed my attitude about practice, and I never forget this. I forget what teacher it was. I was at the Insight Meditation Society halfway through a retreat, and I was ready to go home. I was like, this is actually really stupid. Like, I'm not talking. They want me to just sit here and breathe all day and, like, not talk. I was losing my cool. And I just went into one of the teachers. I was like, yeah, I'm just not feeling it. I was like, why? And I was like, why do you guys do this? This is so ridiculous. And he looked at me and he said, is your mind a friendly companion? And I was like, angry at the question. I was like, is that a rhetorical question? I was like, no. My mind is not a friendly companion. My mind is a bad dude. who just will not leave me alone. He's like, that's why you should meditate. You should meditate until your mind becomes a friendly companion, until your mind becomes an ally, and your mind has your back in all situations in life. Imagine a mind that was just there for you, like your own little internal cheerleader, who's like, no, man, you're doing great. I love you. You're so good. Come on, you can do this. Imagine that. You can, like, train your mind to do that, apparently. Because my mind's like, I don't know, man. Like, you really, really need to get some help on Expedia.com. You know, my mind is like, you know, it will talk me into doing something insane, and then it will judge me later for having done the insane thing it talked me into doing. And I'm like, dude, I just cannot win with you. He's like, well, you do what you want, man. I was just making some suggestions. It becomes the who-me mind. It's like, well, I just, you know, whatever you want to do. I mean, I just, good luck with that. It has no pride, as Joseph Goldstein likes to say. It will turn on a dime. I was just making suggestions. I didn't think you were going to do it. I don't know why you listened to me. You know? So again, these, I like when he talks, he dissolve into laughter. Really trying to integrate mindfulness, loving kindness practices into a system of training where we can actually, because for me, this is the big thing that I really kind of like to, the point I like to make home is that when we start to look at Dharma practice as like, I have a Dharma practice which I do on the cushion for this many amounts of time during the day, and then I have a life. That's really, really a big trap to get into. It's actually, we want to integrate those. Because meditation practice is training. Training, sitting and training, sitting retreats, daily practice is training. The rest of your life is your practice. Sitting in this room right now is your practice. You know, having to pay the tax man is your practice. Getting an argument with your partner is your practice. Dealing with your family is your practice. Like, it's all your practice. Right? And because none of us are probably going to be monastics, we live in a busy, complicated world. Is your life complicated? I know. I'm supposed to teach people not to have complicated lives. Mm-hmm. And I'm like the most complicated person I know. So I must be missing the point. Or perhaps I'm actually doing what I'm supposed to do, and that is learning how to navigate complexity, which is, I think, what mindfulness does, and learning how to have a relational quality towards everything that arises in my experience that doesn't cause suffering for myself and doesn't cause suffering for other people. And I'll tell you, that keeps me busy most days. So I want to save some time for questions. I really appreciate your attention this evening. I hope that some of these ideas are useful to you. So thank you very much.